back to the second hour of this inaugural weekend edition of Truth Jihad Radio right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett. In the first hour, we talked with Paul Zaremka. He will be hanging around and perhaps rejoining us. But right now, I'll be talking with another contributor to the hidden history of 9/11. And to introduce him, well, let me just say that I spent the past week spending a whole lot of time with Colonel Bob Bowman. Bob is one of the great heroes of the 9/11 truth movement and the truth movement in general, a very important whistleblower who resigned, stepped down after having served as the head of the Star Wars space weapons program under Presidents Ford and Carter. He then stepped down and blew the whistle on that program, which is not about defense in any way, shape, or form. It is a purely first-strike weapon system, including the placing of space-based offensive weapons that can fry cities from space, incinerate them instantly, space rocks that can be dropped on opposing missile silos. And all of this is only good if you do it yourself first. If the other side strikes first, they knock out the whole satellite platform and everything's gone. So it's a pure first-strike system. Bob Bowman blew the whistle on that. It's been a great peace voice ever since, and he's been a voice for 9/11 truth in the post-9/11 era. He was here in Wisconsin. I got to hang out with him a bit. Well, I really got to know him best, though, prior to this current national tour, which you can learn about at thepatriots.us. I met him in Boston for the Boston Tea Party for 9/11 truth last December. Well, actually, I met him before that, but we got to spend a lot of time together at the Boston Tea Party for 9/11 truth. And that event, of course, involved throwing the 9/11 Commission report into Boston Harbor. Now, why would we do that? Well, to find out, let's bring on our next guest. It's Brian Sachs, author of a wonderful chapter, an incisive critique of the 9/11 Commission report in Paul Zaremka's book, The Hidden History of 9/11. Brian Sachs is an adjunct professor of philosophy at Drexel University. He's the co-founder and chief writer of Collateral, which is an independent news program at collateralnews.tv. He's taught philosophy at various places, including Rutgers, Temple, and other places. And he has written really the best short critique of the 9/11 Commission report that I've yet read. So welcome, Brian Sachs. How's it going?
Hey, Kevin. Thank you for that. That's nice of you to say.
Hey, it's great to have you on. Yeah, your chapter is quite excellent. People who don't have the time for the long version of David Griffin's book, which came out shortly after the report was released, and who also wants the latest up-to-date information, couldn't really do better than reading your chapter. In fact, I should probably hand that to my opponent in the congressional race here in Wisconsin, Ron Kind, the pro-war Democrat I'm opposing. I gave him a copy of Griffin's book when it came out. And he doesn't appear to have read it, so maybe he'll have time to read your chapter.
I wouldn't. Is he one of the sometimes called blue dog Democrats, Kevin?
Yeah, that's pretty. He's definitely as blue a dog as they come. He's voted for the war at every opportunity. He's voted for every single one of the Bush administration's constitution shredding measures. So yeah, he's pretty well alienated a lot of his base. So I think I actually have a chance of doing surprisingly well against him. But in any case, he certainly was kind of a wasted a wasted case of somebody to hand Griffin's book to. Your chapter does handle, kind of as a concise evisceration of the 9/11 Commission report, and includes both a look at the deeply compromised individuals, or especially key individuals on that commission, as well as some of the flaws in the way it went about its investigation. What led you to investigate the 9/11 Commission report and critique it in this way?
Well, I do have to thank Paul for having the idea of putting together the hidden history and getting it done. It's not an easy thing, I imagine, to get books that are this critical of the official story, particularly when you're talking. You're talking about a subject as profoundly important as 9/11. I had read the New Pearl Harbor, Kevin, and I had been to Toronto in May of 2004 at one of the citizens inquiries, international citizen inquiries that was put together by Barry Zwicker, who's an excellent media Canadian media critic. I'm sure you know Barry.
Oh, sure, yeah. He's a good guy.
And I went up as a kind of interested observer. I had read some things on the internet about September 11th, things that were critical of the official story that sounded like they had some credence to them. And I went to Toronto, I became convinced that this needed more looking into. And this, of course, is right during the time that the 9/11 Commission is doing its work. And shortly after, in the summer of 2004, is when they issued their final report. So I went to a couple of the commission hearings, and I started to look a little bit more closely thereafter at the proceedings and how they went about uncovering their findings. So it was about a year later that Paul had the idea to put this together. The idea came to fruition, and that's when I began writing this.
Okay, and what was it that first struck you that led you to realize just how bad this report was? Is there any particular item of evidence in the report or a name on the commission or what?
Yeah. Well, I remember hearing that Henry Kissinger was going to be the chairman at one point, and that was
a bad sign.
Yeah, that was a bit of an eye opener. After that, there was, I was somewhat like Paul when it came to 9/11 as it happened. I didn't have the suspicions I came to have about the actual, events. I basically believed in the official line. It wasn't any one person or anything in particular. It was only once I came to actually listen to what the commissioners themselves were saying and those who were critical of the commission and what they were saying that I came to think, wait a minute, they're not doing what they say they're going to do. I mean, most importantly, they claim to be a body that was independent, impartial, thorough, and nonpartisan. They plainly weren't. And they plainly weren't independent of influence from power centers. Power centers, by the way, which themselves deserve to be investigated in association with 9/11 attacks. They clearly weren't impartial between competing theories. I mean, they were highly partial towards the official story, which was already well developed by the time they wrote the report. And they clearly were not thorough. I mean, time and again, promising lines of inquiry were dropped or just not looked into completely. The kinds of interviews that were conducted by the commission staff were also of a highly informal kind, not tape recorded, nobody transcribing what's being said.
Just like when Bush and Cheney met with them.
Famously, yes, Bush and Cheney meet for one hour together.
In the White House.
In an untaped session.
No tapes, no notes.
Which those couldn't be taped. I mean, on its face, that's absurd. I would say that's absurd.
Did you ever see the news reports or the film of Bush in the Rose Garden press conference after that meeting?
I'm sure I did at the time. I can't recall any of the images from it. Is there something in particular?
Well, it's a textbook case of guilty demeanor. Bush is asked, repeatedly he's asked, well, people are saying that if you and the vice president had to testify together, that it was to keep your story straight. And Bush's face is just, it's unbelievable. This is included as an extra on Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11, and it's very much worth seeing.
I think, in fact, that's probably where, I did see that movie, I remember. But that's clearly what it would appear to the, to the ordinary person. Why would you have to meet with another person, if he doesn't have his hand in your back and controlling what you're saying? Why do you have to meet with another person for this one-hour period and limit it to that when we're talking, after all, about this most important event, something which you claim you want the bottom to be gotten to about? What would these conditions have to be erected for? So I was troubled by that.
Right. Of course, yeah, Bush has a bit of a history as a loose cannon thing, bizarre things like he witnessed the first plane fly into the tower and so on. I can see why they were worried about what he might say.
You have to probably worry, every day. What I tried to show, Kevin, is that the 9/11 Commission was compromised in key respects. Right from the outset, right, with respect to some of the things we've mentioned already, their connections, the commissioner's connections to areas in government with a big stake in how the report came out, perhaps person with the most obvious set of conflicts was the person most responsible for the report coming out the way it did, and yet one of the most little-known people on the staff, which was the executive director, Philip Zelikow. I mean, you ask the average person on the street, who's Philip Zelikow? They don't know who he is. I mean, I would say not one in 10 people know who Philip Zelikow is. And yet, Philip Zelikow is the executive director, the man who has to recuse himself from that position on a couple of occasions to actually give testimony before the body that he's directed. The man who suspended Condoleezza Rice, who's written a book with her. The man who, after the report's written, goes on to become her top aide. And the man who you ably described last hour as having this self-proclaimed expertise in the development and maintenance of public myth, public perception. And this is the man that's directing the 9/11 Commission.
Yeah, that combination of being a specialist in the creation and maintenance of public myth, and then having authored that pre-9/11 article in Foreign Affairs about the psychological and cultural and political consequences of a massive Pearl Harbor-style terrorist attack such as the destruction of the World Trade Center, you put those two together, and it really makes him look extremely suspicious. I think in the 9/11 truth movement, of all the suspicious characters, you know, besides Cheney himself, I think Larry Silverstein and Philip Zelikow have probably become the most notorious.
Yeah, I mean, among people not paying attention, there's ironies on top of ironies, you know, and that a man with this background should be in a position to actually cement certain public presumptions, right? Things which police are what thought to be true, as he said, but not necessarily true. Right? That's bizarre. That's deeply ironic.
And right.
Nevertheless, there he was.
And that interest in Pearl Harbor that he has that interest, as you write in your article, in steering public events like Pearl Harbor that shape the attitudes of whole generations. And, you know, I put that together with some very interesting information in Douglas Rushkoff's wonderful book, Coercion, which is one of the best books out there on mind control and PR, which are really the same thing.
Rushkoff's an interesting guy. You know, I like a lot of his work. He's written some great stuff about the media, and particularly like reality television and what's beneath that. And yet he's another one who I think when it comes to 9/11 doesn't quite have the openness of mind that I would like.
Well,
to
I think he has. I think it's openness. He has openness of mind. He just won't go there publicly. I sent him a copy of my article, Apocalypse of Coercion, which is a sort of a takeoff of his book Coercion, and it's applied in a very hardcore way to 9/11. He wrote back and saying, "Yes, I agree with you completely. This is great. By the way, have you seen this BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares? I'm totally on board with that guy." So I think he's actually. I've been working on him ever since, and I haven't been able to get him on the show or to really have him come out of the closet. But no, I think he's aware of the problems with 9/11, but. But the point is that in his book Coercion, Rushkoff discusses this guy who was the leading focus group leader, the genius of focus groups, who was hired by the military to do a whole part of a project on the effect of Pearl Harbor on Americans' attitudes towards the Japanese, based on what they discovered. Well, they'd already known some of this, but they went and learned everything they could about it. The fact that Americans still blamed the Japanese in the 80s and 90s for what had happened at Pearl Harbor almost 50 years before, and they discovered that there was a sense that Japan had punctured America's invulnerability, and that this led to a prolonged antagonism against Japanese people. And I think that all of this may have contributed to 9/11 as a psychological operation designed to foster hatred that would last for generation upon generation against Arabs and Muslims. And this, of course, would be advantageous for American and especially Israeli geostrategic interests.
I agree. I wonder, Kevin, if you've ever had on your program or would be interested in having Diana Rolfe on the program.
I would love to have her. Please send me her contact
info. I don't know Diana other than an email exchange, I think, from years ago. But her piece in our collection, Islamophobia and the War on Terror, I remember Paul had given me a draft of that, and I had read it since. It's quite good. I find it to be quite good in lots of places. So,
I agree completely. And then, now that I recall that it is posted at 9/11 Blogger, one of the two chapters that's up there, I have to compliment 9/11 Blogger for doing that, because it is a terrific piece. Yes, so Zelikow, of course, is well known now within the serious 9/11 truth community for his extreme suspiciousness of his background and his conflicts of interest. But he's not the only one. In fact, if you go through all of those 9/11 commissioners, it seems like almost all of them have some kind of conflict of interest, skeleton in the closet, what have you. And then you've zeroed in on a couple of the most obvious ones. But, you know, we're going into a break here, so I don't know if you'll have time to go into that until we come back.
Sure.
Just give me a couple of names. Give me a couple of names you can bring up.
There was, of course, Lee Hamilton, who's made something of a name for himself as you know, a person willing to accept the lying of powerful people even when you know, there isn't evidence to support their innocence.
Right, cover up on contra days.
Jamie Gorelick, who may have taken part in a DOJ cover up.
Okay, we'll talk about them when we.
You're listening to We the People Radio Network. Pure energy. We the People Radio Network.
Welcome back. This is the Truth Jihad Radio Show in its new weekend home. 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett, and right now I'm talking with Brian Sachs. He's an adjunct professor of philosophy at Drexel University with a lot of other scholarly credits to his name, and he is a contributor to The Hidden History of 9/11. The new paperback edition is out, edited by Paul Zaremka, who was on earlier, and will be hanging around perhaps to join us a little later. And we were just talking about the deeply compromised nature of the people who were selected to serve on the 9/11 Commission. The one honest guy, Max Cleland, stepped down and said he didn't want to be the part of another Warren Commission cover-up. And but so the people who were left were pretty dubious, and you just named a couple of them. So maybe Brian, you could refresh our memories and go over with Jamie Gorelick. And who was the other one you named?
I mentioned Lee Hamilton.
Lee Hamilton, that's right, yeah, Iran-Contra cover-up guy.
Yeah, well, let me just say briefly, Kevin, that most all the commissioners had some sort of connection, which if people were really being scrupulous in the selection of commissioners, would have disqualified them. I mean, say Gordon's firm, his lawyer worked, had Delta Airlines as a client, James Thompson's firm, had American Airlines as a client in the past. Fred Fielding also, Richard Benvenise had represented both Boeing and I think another of the airlines, United maybe. I mean, all of these, you know, obviously the airline industry had an enormous stake still at this time, that there are lawsuits in the courts, for instance, seeking damages for which some of them may have been liable. That should have disqualified them. But in the cases of, say, Lee Hamilton and Jamie Gorelick, some would see more serious conflicts of interest. I mean, Gorelick is the assistant attorney general in the, Justice Department during the Clinton administration. And she, among other things, may have been involved in a cover-up associated with TWA's Flight 800 that actually Peter Lance and David Ray Griffin pick up in some detail. It's a very convoluted story. I don't know if you know the outline of it, Kevin.
Yeah, you know, I did read two of Peter Lance's books, and I'm still a little unclear on it all. But I also saw your treatment of it in the article. Why don't you just give us the short version?
Yeah, the short version is that Peter Lance argued in Cover Up that a man by the name of Greg Scarpa Jr., who was a witness in the TWA Flight 800 case. But his the information that he came to have would have undermined the official version of that story. He was also a key witness in a case against, I don't want to confuse it here. There was an FBI agent named Linda Vecchio, who I think has been in his case has been in the news recently also, who was deeply corrupt. And if he could be shown to be corrupt, as many as 9 other high-profile convictions that the law enforcement had won, and had made careers for a number of prominent people, they would have been jeopardized, right?
And, he was really corrupt. He was participating in mob hits.
That's right. And he had information that would have discredited this guy. Thus, from the standpoint of expediency, it was Scarpa Jr., the witness, that had to be discredited, okay? And that meant that the best evidence, the best Flight 800 evidence, had to, you know, be covered up and buried along with Scarpa and his credibility, right? So it's Gorelick who is likely an accomplice in this act. And I would refer people to Lance's book for the particulars. And the way that Griffin, I'm going to page to the quote from Griffin, if you don't mind, Kevin, in my chapter here. The way Griffin put it was that those in the Department of Justice and FBI who decided to cover up the truth about this crash, such as Jamie Gorelick, may well have believed their decision was justifiable. Nevertheless, they would surely, especially after 9/11, not want to help reveal the fact that they had lied, and in doing so covered up his prior Al-Qaeda attack on America. That's Griffin from Omissions and Distortions, I believe. And Jamie Gorelick is a commissioner. Right. And she's one of two people, along with Zelikow, who's permitted to read, you know, sensitive papers that the White House is blocking the rest of the commissioners from seeing. So this isn't, again, what you would expect to see in a commission that's supposed to be independent, right?
Right. Well, certainly, you know, along with Hamilton and Gorelick being involved in earlier cover-ups, there are a couple of other pretty interesting aspects of some of these commissioners. Like, I believe Standard Hicks reports that Richard Benveniste was Barry Seal's attorney, Barry Seal being the notorious CIA drug runner. And according to Standard Hicks, again, I'm going from memory, I read his book a couple of years ago, Benveniste was briefly being implicated by Barry Seal. Barry was turning state's evidence against his own attorney, Benveniste, when Barry Seal was gunned down at a red light in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Had you looked into that?
I remember reading from Dennis, one of Hopsicker's, Daniel Hopsicker's reports, information to that effect. And just the larger point is that if you have commissioners on a body that's supposed to be independent and doing a thorough job, if they're compromised in ways, that is, if there's things about them that they wouldn't want let out, for the light of day to be seen, then they can be influenced not to go to places that are going to embarrass or, you know, open up, you know, powerful people to further investigation. And it does seem like there are people like that on the commission.
And that seems to be a real common modus operandi in high levels of power. J. Edgar Hoover was notorious, of course, for keeping files on just about every powerful person in Washington and elsewhere. And it, you know, really helps explain why.
Absolutely. And it's not just, you don't have to go back even as far as J. Edgar Hoover, of course, Kevin. During the time where the Congressional Joint Inquiry is looking into the FBI's conduct, the FBI announces that they're going to do an investigation of those people, of some of those people who are conducting the joint inquiry. And so intimidation is still a part and parcel of the way that, you know, the FBI sometimes operates in these matters. I mean, I think anybody, again, who is truly impartial and objective would say that an investigation like this ought to be done by competent people outside the spheres of power. Give them access. And trust them to go wherever the investigation leads. Don't get in their way. Instead, that's not what happened. What happened, of course, is that insiders were trusted with this, with the very foreseeable consequence that we didn't see promising lines of inquiry followed. And it was such an important matter that they not be, that even when when the victim's family, the steering committee for the victim's family members, asked, basically pleaded, and after all, it was only, we only have a 9/11 commission because of their great efforts over 14 months to push one. When they requested to have one of their members of their leadership on the 9/11 commission, they were flatly denied that. And I thought it would have been perfectly reasonable for that to happen. But I think it does go to this desire to keep the 9/11 commission as a kind of closed group so that information could be managed and controlled.
And was it ever managed and controlled? Well, we are going into a break right now, but can you stick around for one more segment, possibly, Brian? Because we do have a caller with a question for you. We'll bring him on after the break. This is Kevin Barrett doing the new weekend edition of Truth Jihad Radio on We the People Radio Network. I'm devoting this weekend to some of the best scholarly work on 9/11, including the editor and some contributors to the hidden history of 9/11. We'll also bring on the dean of 9/11 studies himself, David Ray Griffin, tomorrow. So we'll be right back here. Stay tuned.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Truth Jihad Radio in its new 2 to 4 p.m. Central Time weekend format right here at We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett talking with some leading 9/11 scholars this weekend, and my guest right now is Brian Sachs. He's the author of Making History, the Compromised 9/11 Commission, the best short treatment of the weaknesses of that commission, although, of course, it's impossible to really do a short treatment that would include even a reasonable selection of the omissions, distortions, and outright lies in that scandalous book. Well, we do have a caller online. It's Chris calling back from Oklahoma. Welcome, Chris. How's it going?
Hey, Kevin. Normally I don't call in twice on the show, but I want to thank Brian publicly for his excellent work. He was a contributing writer on the article in Hustler a couple of years ago about the expose of McVeigh and being in Camp Grafton in North Dakota during the three to three and a half month time slot that the FBI lost complete track of him. So, Brian, we really appreciate your excellent work on that and the work you continue to do on 9/11. I did want to add a comment about Jamie Gorelick, and we do have a documentation to show that she was complicit in the, misdirection of the investigation of the Oklahoma City bombing. She had actually called in. We did get this firsthand from an employee of the Oklahoma County District Attorney's Office here in the Oklahoma City. There were at least nine individuals in their boardroom. Jamie Gorelick called in within 3 days after the bombing and gave everyone in that room the marching orders and how the investigation was going to be handled. And she went from top to bottom, all the way from the FBI on down. And this individual was astonished. Not only was she demonstrative, that's an understatement, she was screaming at the top of her lungs on the phone, telling these people over the speakerphone what was going to happen, how they were going to handle the investigation, and period. There was no exceptions. And everybody in that room was stunned, including the district attorney, former district attorney Bob Macy. So when I saw her name on the 9/11 Commission report and Philip Zelikow, I said, this thing's going in the tank, just by the example that she set here in Oklahoma City. Anyway, I just thought I'd share it with you all.
Chris, it's great to hear from you again.
Take care.
All right.
Okay. Bye.
Yeah. I wanted to actually get a chance to ask Chris, because that would have been 1995, right, Kevin? That would have been when she was, assistant to Dan Arena. I would love to get the documentation on that. I'd really like to look at that. I hadn't heard that story before.
Maybe Chris can
forward it to your producer or
okay. Well, he could always call back again. He'd set an all-time record, I think, if he called in three times on my show.
I think that's Chris Emery who's.
It certainly is. Yeah. That's a lot of great work. Yeah, he's done great work. He's at OKCBombing.org. He's recently broken some new information on 9/11, some receipts and eyewitness testimony putting some of the alleged hijackers in OKC shortly before 9/11 and one of them after 9/11. So, yeah, getting back to the weaknesses of these people, it is pretty interesting how these same dubious characters just keep popping up like bad pennies for each of these kinds of events. You know, we've seen that with a scientific or pseudoscientific justification for the official stories of what happened to the Murrah building in Oklahoma City. Some of those same people then showed up directing the first FEMA investigation of the World Trade Center, quote-unquote, collapses. And then those same people moved over to NIST. And so you have these, you know, it seems like they have a very limited roster of people they keep going to for these cover-ups.
Could I actually speak about another aspect of what I wrote, Kevin, in the short time we have left, just in the way of looking forward to what might be some future, you know, horrible event, and then the news coverage of that event, which will inevitably follow?
Okay, what's your take on that?
Well, I had written in this piece that the official explanation of 9/11 is a deeply conventional one. And I meant by conventional the sense of the word that was used by a man named William Yerichio, an MIT writer. And briefly, what he explains is that all cultures have narratives of explanation that are circulating in them at any given time, and they're ready to be drawn on in order to simplify events for public consumption whenever something new and frightening and enormously complex happens, like, say, 9/11. So in America, these narratives include, you know, we're the good guys. In fact, we're the only true good guys. And we would never attack another country in self-defense. So if something like this happens, obviously it's these terrible evildoers that, you know, struck us for no reason except they're completely insane or murderers, right?
Well, they hate our freedom.
And they hate our freedom, of course. I mean, that was the treatment, right? I mean, that was the encapsulation of it. Why do they hate our freedom? Now, of course, a lot of this, you know, a lot of these narratives are just based on fiction, but they also exist as a kind of, like, really solid cultural common sense. So on 9/11, and I didn't know this at the time, Kevin. I mean, like I said, I was subject to these forces at that time. It was only after the fact that I think I became more aware of the way these kinds of things operate. So, you know, on 9/11, you have the corporate media, I mean, almost immediately imposing form on the raw events that are coming in that day. And the messages that they were conveying, even that morning and the days that following, you know, they're still there. You know, they're very useful in constructing a story that's powerful, you know, becomes more powerful through repetition. And when it's a story that, you know, is approved of by elites in society, it's going to get repeated again and again and again and again. And this happens not only with, you know, this didn't only happen on 9/11, as part of Yerichio's point. It happens with just about any large event about which, you know, there's new information coming all the time. Form gets imposed on it, and that form typically is this kind of conventional form. And we should be aware of that next time, you know, a large and frightening event inevitably happens. You know, be aware of the way that information is being managed and presented to you to try and present a particular picture and not some other picture. Right?
Well, that's a good point. I've actually been involved in a sort of hands-on project to try to get that skeptical mindset out there in case of another large event like 9/11 by distributing these inside job signs, 2-foot by 3-foot plastic, highly visible signs saying inside job ? And around the edges are the leading 9/11 truth websites. Just in case something happens, people can take these signs out in public and, you know, block freeway traffic if you want to be adventurous or otherwise get into a visible position. And the idea being that if all of the 3,000 or so of these signs that are out there are used in this manner, it would have some impact. And just the fact that they're out there theoretically could be a bit of a deterrent to the bad guys. But, yeah, of course, that's operating at a somewhat different level. You're suggesting that maybe academics in particular should perhaps be thinking this through and helping us spread this message in a thoughtful and critical way.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, a lot of them have, obviously. You know, I mean, this isn't, I'm borrowing the work of William Ruricchio here, who I don't think is a 9/11 truth movement person. I would borrow some other elements of media analysis from another person who is not a member of 9/11 truth movement, Noam Chomsky, and just use them for purposes of critical thinking and enabling other people, and I do this with my students, to, you know, have the fundamentals of it there ready when they're being asked to, accept what's presented to them. I think that's vitally important in a free society because, you know, the way that we get, that is, you know, citizens of a free society get manipulated isn't, you know, typically by, you know, threat of brute force, although we're getting further in that direction, unfortunately. It's typically through more subtle forms of manipulation, media and otherwise. I mean, you have media itself an enormous business closely connected with elements in big business, some of the same personnel in both. You have in government this kind of revolving door between military contractors and the executive positions in the White House. So you're going to have a mindset that develops in all these institutions that, you know, is convergent, going to be similar, and it's going to get expressed in their products. And, you know, there needs to be a counterbalance to that, and you need the thinking public to understand that, to really, you know, defend against, you know, that kind of hegemony.
It sure does. And the Internet has been a great tool for that, including Internet radio shows like the one we're on. Brian, can you come for the last segment after this break?
I'll do my best. I might have to jump out before, but I'll do my best.
Okay, great. We'll be back with Brian Sachs and then maybe finish up with a last word from Paul Zaremka when we come back. This is Kevin Barrett on Truth Jihad Radio. To the first ever weekend episode of Truth Jihad Radio, right here on We the People Radio Network. I'm Kevin Barrett, talking with some leading 9/11 scholars this opening weekend. It's been a great opening show here with Paul Zaremka, editor of The Hidden History of 9/11, and Brian Sachs, a contributor to the critique of the 9/11 Commission report in that volume. Tomorrow we'll have David Ray Griffin, the Dean of 9/11 Studies, and Jay Kolar, author of the opening essay in that volume, treating what's known about the alleged 9/11 hijackers. And with what's known, you better lay a heavy stress on that word, alleged hijackers. Future guests coming up on my shows include Mark Gaffney, author of the upcoming book, The 9/11 Mystery Plane and the Vanishing of America, Kirkpatrick Sale of the Middlebury Institute on Secession, and Lynn Margulis, one of the planet's leading scientists. To find out more about these guests and the future shows, you can go to barrettforcongress.us and click on the radio shows link. Okay, well, Brian, you're saying that we need to encourage critical thinking and skepticism and a consciousness of the way that the authorities reinforce these hegemonic narratives or these stories that serve their interests, especially in the face of cataclysmic or major events like 9/11. And in particular, if anything like that happens again, we really need to be more aware of that. And do you think, I did want to ask you that when you were talking about the media harping on the official story and reinforcing it, drumming it in through repetition, what do you think about the likelihood that the media, or at least some of the media response to 9/11, was pre-scripted? That's something that has been argued in about both ways by people in the 9/11 research community.
I'm not sure what you mean. What do you mean pre-scripted?
Well, for instance, the BBC reported the collapse of Building 7 early. Some suggest that the reason was that this, you know, these kinds of reports are being put out by perhaps intelligence sources within the, you know, the media network, and you know the reporting is being spun directly as it happens by, for instance, people were all set to go with the Pearl Harbor reference. Some people would argue that that was already in the minds of some of these media people before 9/11. While others would say that no, they just responded to an attack on America by making that natural linkage to Pearl Harbor.
I remember that day where the maybe a year and a half ago or however long it was, where that tape of the British people, the BBC reporter talking about the collapse of World Trade Center 7, and it's visible there in the background. And then look at that, it comes down a few minutes later. I think that doesn't necessarily, of course, prove that there was this feeding by intelligence to news programs of that information. It could be attributable to the way that news agencies regularly do their news. I think that they do not script things. They are preparing for events, and when they hear some information that's not 100% accurate or that's expected, they may report it as had already happened. I don't know. I know there was a big flap about that, and I have to admit that after those couple of days, I didn't look into it any further. But, I mean, I suppose it's not impossible, but I didn't come away from that particular flap thinking that the BBC, I just mistakenly reported an event that was going to happen beforehand, and that therefore that was evidence that of the kind of scripting.
Yeah, well, I think scripting would normally be not so much that anybody or everybody in the media outlet in question knows about it, just that the report comes in from the intelligence source.
She must have got. I mean, I would say that in this case, they must have gotten information about 7 being in danger from somewhere, and
that information out there,
right? I mean, if there's an innocent explanation, the best you can say to the BBC is they just flat got it wrong. It's still a big problem to report things that are flatly incorrect, because at least what it does is it calls into question your credibility and whether or not you ought to be reporting on events of such a monumental nature when you can't be bothered to even check your facts before you step onto the air. I mean, anybody can step on the air and say stuff that's incorrect and not checked, but if you do that and you make these mistakes, what's the accountability for them? What's the penalty? I think because there's so much pressure sometimes, on these news agencies to get a scoop, that they don't take the efforts they should to check things. And the really bad part of that, I suppose, is when it comes to things like national defense or news about military, military doings. They just rely on Pentagon press releases or what they're told without doing the proper investigation before it gets to the air. That winds up having often a propagandistic effect, I would say.
Right. Well, with intelligence operations, as 9/11 appears to have been, there is always that media component of how will this event be reported. Examples include, of course, that all the background information on Lee Harvey Oswald was put out there before it could have been known, at least in one outlet in New Zealand. And on 9/11, we had Harley Guy telling us that these buildings had collapsed because the jet fuel melted the steel, and he's reporting it so blithely that most people who see that think that this guy is not just somebody who happened by on a Harley. And they were naming Bin Laden almost instantly on 9/11, and the 19 guys who whose names turned up in Otta's magic suitcase, they were all being named the next day. All of this leads many to think that there was a heavily scripted side to the information that came through the media, so whether or not the media people themselves were complicit.
Yeah, and one thing I would say for sure is that, the scripted question aside, the 9/11 Commission was meant to be another hammer blow against even the suggestion that U.S. intelligence may have had foreknowledge or even been complicit in the attack. I mean, it was another but on the political left, to policing the boundary, the so-called, you know, respectable discussion about 9/11. It's disappointing to me that people who I respect, you know, for their political analysis in so many subjects, when the subject comes to 9/11, don't even seem willing to entertain the possibility that, you know, U.S. intelligence could have, I mean, I'm not even asking them to consider the possibility that, you know, U.S. intelligence actually conducted the attack.
Did I make a comment here? This is Paul?
Paul.
Oh, yeah, Paul, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to make a comment on this. On the Brian's making a comment about the left gatekeepers, right, Brian? That's basically what you're trying to say.
Yeah, I mean, I don't usually use the term any longer, gatekeepers, only because I think it's gotten misused.
Right. Well, I just want to, the only
people
point
on the left do are blocking critical thinking on this.
Right, but I just want to make a couple of points. One is that we also, I mean, the corporate media, which the corporations can be considered right-wing, I mean, they have so much more power than the left does in terms of defining the discussion that we shouldn't forget that. And the other thing I want to point out is that this, my volume, which you're a part, is part of a left-wing tradition, not a right-wing tradition, which I think is of some importance, that people realize that there are people on the left that are criticizing 9/11, not just people on the right.
Oh, I hope I didn't come across that way, Paul. I'm expressing my disappointment as somebody who places himself on the political left, and, you know, is hoping for this kind of, you know, movement on the left towards an openness to these kinds of,
Good. I mean, that's I know you, so I know that that's where you're coming from. But I was maybe talking more to the listeners and to Kevin, just so people know where we're coming from.
Right.
It's ridiculous in my mind that you should, you know, that if somebody's holding a sign that says inside job question mark, it's ridiculous to expend energy to dismiss them as a lunatic. You engage them. You ask them, you know, what they think. Now, of course, I have myself run into plenty of people who have ideas that, in the 9/11 truth movement that I think are false, baseless. But, you know, to then, because those people who say that there are no planes, for instance, that hit the towers, which I find to be ludicrous, obviously, you know, because people say that nobody who has anything critical to say of the official story should be heard. I mean, they don't follow from one another. And yet that's this effort that I see, at least in elements on the left, try and conflate the idea that there was a conspiracy in this matter with the claim that there's some sort of giant grand world conspiracy, which I don't hear David Reddy Griffin saying, I don't hear Paul Thompson saying, I don't hear the Visa Med saying, I'm not saying, and I don't hear Paul
Graham. Right, you're exactly right.
Right. There are lots of conspiracies in history, but history is not a conspiracy. Okay, well, hey, it's been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much, Brian Sachs and Paul Zaremka.
Thank you.
Okay. I wish you well in the success of your terrific book, The Hidden History of 9/11, now available in paperback. Check it out. Take care, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
All right, this is Kevin Barrett. Check me out at barrettforcongress.us. I'll be back tomorrow, same time, same channel, with David Ray Griffin and Jay Kolar. See you then.
The Bill of Rights protects every American's God-given right to keep and bear arms. Now that right is being seriously undermined as legally registered rifles are being confiscated in some parts of our country. If we're not careful, we may find ourselves with no right to own guns. And that's where Gun Owners of America comes in. Gun Owners of America is in Washington every day fighting for you to keep that right. Congressman Ron Paul has called GOA the only no-compromise gun lobby in Washington. You need to be part of this great grassroots group of activists who are keeping the heat on their members of Congress. Find out right now how you can join. Call 888-886-GUNS and get started receiving their fact-filled newsletters and action alerts. Call 888-886-GUNS or go to their webpage at gunowners.org and help make your voice heard in Washington. Make that call right now and call Gun Owners of America at 888-886-GUNS. Remember, it's not just about gun control, it's about control.